Welcome to the Campus Energy and Sustainability Podcast. In each episode, we talk with leading campus professionals, thought leaders, engineers, and innovators addressing the unique challenges and opportunities facing higher ed and corporate campuses. Our discussions will range from energy conservation and efficiency to planning and finance, from building science to social science, from energy systems to food systems. We hope you're ready to learn, share, and ultimately accelerate your institution towards solutions. I'm your host, Dave Carlscott. I'm the Vice President of Infrastructure, Energy, and Sustainability at Brailsford & Dunleavy.
We've had opportunities to have students to walk the buses, to see the charging stations. They are all opportunities that educators have inquired about. I think that's the part of the return of the investment that you just can't measure with, you know, a spreadsheet.
Hi, I'm Will Mangler, President at Brailsford & Dunleavy. Welcome to the Campus Energy and Sustainability Podcast. It's my pleasure to introduce today's guest, Mr. Jason Washington, Associate Superintendent of Prince George's County Public Schools, a dedicated leader in education, and a passionate advocate for student success, who happens to be my fraternity brother. Jason began his career as a teacher and has continuously sought roles where he can make a meaningful impact. His work spans law, community development, and public service, all driven by a commitment to equity and opportunity. Currently, he leads the development and implementation of the nation's first K-12 bundled schools concessionaire model here in Prince George's County. Before this role, Jason served as an executive director of the National Council for Public-Private Partnerships and held leadership positions at Corvius and City First Enterprise. He also has been a White House fellow at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, a senior policy advisor to the mayor of Baltimore, and practiced corporate law at Kirtland and Ellis LLP. With a strong record of driving innovation, empowering educators, and improving student outcome, Jason's leadership continues to shape the future of education in one of the most diverse school districts in the country. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Jason Washington.
Jason, it's great to have you on the podcast today.
Well, it's a pleasure, Dave. Thank you so much. Looking forward to our conversation.
Let's start with just an introduction to who you are as an individual, and then we'll get into the project that we want to discuss today.
I'm Jason Washington, Associate Superintendent of Supporting Services for Prince George's County Public Schools, which is a long title for basically Deputy Chief Operating Officer for the school district. So I manage the Division of Operations, so seven different divisions: transportation, food service, security, as well as building services, capital programs, sustainability and resiliency, and our alternative infrastructure office. I have been with the school system for 5 years, and I am a recovery attorney. That's a little about me and the role that I have right now.
It was interesting looking at your history on LinkedIn. You've been a seventh grade teacher, I saw, as well. You have quite the varied background.
Yeah, I started my career as a teacher. I learned very quickly that I had a passion for education, but it was not going to be in front of the classroom, and had a circuitous path to get back here. But everything happens for a reason, and very happy to now take the experiences that I've had in other places and in the private sector to utilize them on behalf of our students, 130,000 students here in Prince George's County.
That's great. Well, as a recovering music major and a recovering software developer, I appreciate a good circuitous path to your role. Well, I know today we want to really lean into some of the fleet electrification work that you've been doing at the school district. In particular, it sounds like some of the work you've been doing around electrification of school buses. But let's maybe start, just give us a little bit of the background on the program. I know this came out of some of your climate action planning efforts and some of the larger goals for the state and the county.
Yeah, really where this took off was, I would say probably 2018 or so. The community really started to ask Prince George's County, what are we doing to really embrace sustainability, resiliency, really from a standpoint of school construction, but overall, we are a massive anchor institution within the county, you know, that should be a leader And that should not only say what we're doing, but to demonstrate that in our actions. And that really led to the work group that started, that ended up developing the Climate Change Action Plan that was adopted in 2021. And within there, there are facets both on sustainability, resiliency, EV buses, as well as net zero schools. It was just an all-inclusive, real blueprint of how we as a school system wanted to demonstrate our commitment to sustainability and resiliency. And so that's how it started. And then it has now really morphed into development of a new office, the Department of Sustainability and Resiliency, and then also populating our other departments with pieces of implementation of this program as well that fit better with them. So with EV buses, transportation has a role in that. And then our Office of Alternative Infrastructure is our vehicle to look at how we can utilize different financing opportunities and not just PAYGO to pay for some of these improvements and also sustainable targets that we have.
Yeah, let's maybe lean into the electric fleet piece in particular. What brought you to that specifically? How did that fit into your program? Like, where did you even get started in thinking about electrification of vehicles?
I think it was really around pilot opportunities that were shown across the country. One of the unique features of Prince George's County is that it's both urban and very rural, depending on where you are. And roughly, approximately, I think we have 490 square miles. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. And that's where we wanted to make sure that we did think through, you know, how we could, you know, start to incorporate electric vehicle charging in a way that was thoughtful and I think just more measured than just going buying up as many as we could at first. And so, but that's where it's really started was, you know, the opportunity to have pilot opportunities and grant opportunities to start that process for us. And so it made a lot of sense, especially in some of our urban core areas. That's what we really started looking at. And quite honestly, we felt that that is where we need to be going. From an environmental standpoint, a sustainability standpoint, and for us, the potential savings in diesel and other type of expenses that we, you know, that we're paying for every year in our annual budget.
Great. Well, maybe talk a little bit about what you've done so far and maybe what some of your aspirations are going, you know, in terms of like how many buses or vehicles are you even talking about? What are the ranges of them? I appreciate that you have kind of a mix of urban and rural. I imagine, you know, I grew up in rural Montana, so I think there were kids that bussed in from like an hour away for some of our schools, where now that I live in Seattle, it's a much different landscape where kids just take school buses. But maybe talk a little bit about just the landscape, just to give people a flavor of what you're working with.
So we started with the mandate. The Climate Change Action Plan has a stated goal, be a 100% electrified bus fleet by 2040. And so that is where we started. Now that we've started to implement this, that is not a sustainable target. So we are adjusting that both from a mostly fiscal standpoint, quite honestly, but also just in terms of making sure that we don't outgrow the infrastructure and that we don't out advance necessarily and overwhelm the infrastructure that's in place. We currently have 21 buses that really were funded through joint state and federal funds and grant programs. We have another 8 that are coming, and those have been funded through the Maryland Energy Administration Electric Bus Grant Program. But, you know, there were 8 more that we had ordered that will not be fulfilled because those were tied to the EPA Electric Vehicle Bus Rebate Program. And so has really, you know, impacted how we've thought through the incorporation of electric vehicles and electric buses particularly. But at the same time, it has made sure that we are thoughtful around our allocations each year
is because the cost of electric vehicle EV buses are more than diesel. And so, you know, we have to make the business case that is not just bottom line dollars and cents, but it's the long-term savings across, you know, not just dollars, but emissions. Also, the educational opportunities that exist for teaching our students about the buses and the technology that are also factored into, you know, how we have got into, you know, incorporating electric buses into our fleet and into the school district.
Great. So it's not, I mean, that it sounds like a good start. Roughly how many buses do you have overall? Like what percentage would that represent?
That would represent very small. We have over 1,000 buses. We are changing out each year roughly 100 at a time. So that's where the be a fully electrified fleet by 2040 would, in a normal cycle, that's why it would have been about 15 years, because we would have been changing out 100 buses a year. And so that's where, you know, it was very measured and thoughtful when we implemented it. It's just now the reality has changed. But that's how we would have gotten to the fully electrified fleet by 2040.
Great. And it sounds like for the most part so far, they've been grant funded, purchased by the district, not necessarily leased or another financial structure. Is that
correct? Correct.
Great. Has that worked out for you? I mean, has that made sense? Obviously, somebody donates the money to you and you can use it. The implication then is like maintenance and things like that. Is that, how's that worked?
Maintenance for sure. But then also, you know, making sure that we are utilizing the buses for a while, you know, we had some bus drivers that were nervous, scared to drive them. Also the education and the training aspect, and also the charging infrastructure, making sure that that was in place and being thoughtful about where they would deploy. The big piece here for us really was around actually the delivery. We're tied up for a while because of just supply chain backups. I think we are at 21 buses going to 28, 29 here. We probably would have closer to 40, 45 if it was the same supply chain, robust supply chain that we see on the diesel side. And so that was something we just had to get used to, is that when you're putting out orders, I've learned this for bus ordering, you put out an order in July is where we usually do it. And by early spring, the buses are being delivered. It's not that same, not yet anyway, or all our experience rather, hasn't been that same predictability. And so that has added a little bit of learning curve for us as well.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, I find this story really fascinating just because you are a lot further along than a lot of districts, which is great, and which is, I was really excited to talk to you about this. You mentioned a few things there. Maybe we can dig into them individually. You said some of the drivers were nervous about driving them. Like, how did you get over that? Or have you gotten over that? Or is that continue to be a challenge? Or what has been their experience once they've actually driven them?
When actually driving them, they're fine. I think it's the whole, they've heard the worst stories. Oh, it catches on fire, or you have to let it this or that. What we've seen has been that the drivers overall have been very comfortable once they've gotten into it and trained and realize this is just a regular bus. Just, you know, because, you're worried about like, what if I run out of charging? What if I do this? And we're like, trust us. Like you, it's not just going to stop on you on a dime. But then it's also, you know, how does this bus, you know, adapt to weather changes? How does this, like, so it's all of those pieces that, you know, they just want to make sure that they know everything. And I think it was just the more of that, instead of us just tossing them a key and say, drive this bus. It was more around breaking it down. But then once they've driven, and you know, my daughter rides the bus and to school, and there are a couple of electric buses that pick her up, and quiet as could be. Like, it is literally and that has come back too from the drivers, is that it's just, you know, a more, you know, enjoyable drive sometimes. You have the bus making noise along with the kids, so at least now you can isolate it to just the kids, so to speak.
But they're still noisy, just for the right reasons.
Yeah. Just, and so, but overall, I mean, but I think no small part to our transportation team that really embraced getting up to speed on it and being trained themselves to be able to speak knowledgeably on it and to meet the drivers where they are.
That's great. How have the kids reacted? It sounds like your daughter likes it, but...
Oh, yeah, they've enjoyed it. I think, you know, if you get picked up at 7 o'clock for school, I don't think you care what the bus is. You're just upset that you're on the bus at 7 and you wanted to sleep in. But no, I think we have really, you know, the opportunity for students for learning. Like, you know, when we've had opportunities to have the buses for students to walk the buses, to see the charging stations, there are all opportunities that I know some of our educators have inquired about and have done with our transportation department with the buses. And I think that's the part of the return of the investment that you just can't measure with, you know, a spreadsheet, so to speak.
Well, one other big constituency, especially for your elementary age kids, would be your parents. Have they reacted well, or what's that been response? What's the response been there?
It's been well received. I think that it's the fact that, you know, it is on time and quiet. And I definitely feel that in certain neighborhoods is very well received just because of communities that are more focused on sustainability measures and resiliency than others. And so being able to see us following through with that and, you know, providing and being a leader in green technology is something that we've heard from parents that have been very happy. We have not heard any parent upset. Let me put it that way.
That's great.
We'll take pleasure in that anecdotal evidence.
Yeah, my experience working with school districts, you'll know if people don't like something, yeah, right?
Very quickly.
Well, that's great. Let's maybe lean a little bit more into the tech aspects of this. So I'd be curious to learn a little bit more about the charging infrastructure. These buses need a lot of power to get charged up. Was that a major barrier to getting them installed, or would that come with the initial grants, or how have you guys managed the charging infrastructure, because you basically need your own gas station and unlike, you know, that infrastructure somewhere else for a diesel bus.
And that's literally where we are right now. So for the buses that we have three mobile chargers that we have at the lot with the buses. What we've also had to do is we've had to adjust the routes so that we ensure that, you know, they're not all coming back drained completely because we only have three chargers. So it's that interchange right now, while we move forward with basically retrofitting an existing bus lot. We had one bus lot identify, but the routes were going to be consistently long because it was further out. So now we've made an adjustment to a more urban bus lot that's literally right in the middle of a city center that allows for broader access where we will put in the infrastructure that's there. So our Office of Alternative Infrastructure Planning and Development is working right now on the development of a RFQ and RFP to go out to the market for a developer to help them develop. Really, are we doing a microgrid? Are we going to do a combination of just chargers, you know, install chargers with the local utilities? How do we take advantage with, you know, tax rebates, you know, going away in certain cases? What does that look like? How do we make it pencil out? So that's the next piece of this. And that's where we will probably pause on purchasing buses until we get the infrastructure in place to where we are not having buses sit idly by because we don't have enough sufficient charging capability. And so those have been the next steps in this proof of concept. The buses work. You charge them, they will run. They're just like any other buses. Now that requires us to put in the necessary infrastructure that, you know, and calibrate it to what our future looks like. We don't need to do a bus lot of 300 chargers right now, but we need to, you know, have substantial capacity if we need to expand. Because, you know, as I've talked to our team, priorities change, administrations change, things change. So we have to be open and flexible to adapt as we need to. And that's kind of how we're approaching it right now.
That's great. I guess backing up a step, you said you had three mobile chargers. That's kind of, so these are basically like giant batteries that you charge somewhere else and then you can move them around. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So they came with the buses. That was part of grant funding that we had. And what we have is on each lot where we have electric buses, we have, I think two of them are high-speed chargers. One is regular charger. We have allocated it to 5 to 7 buses per charger. And what we have is we have different runs. So we have a morning run, that bus comes back, charges. We have afternoon. So they have it on a pretty good, I guess, routine in terms of charging. But those have allowed us the flexibility to see where we can maximize the use of the buses. So we're not tied to, well, we only have a charger built in right here, so we have to stay here. It gives us that ability, and it gave us that ability to really pressure test to determine where to be. And that's how we determine the need for moving it to a more centralized lot with shorter routes and more frequent routes, so that we felt like we could get more for the charge than what we see in some of our outer rim lots at this point.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that's great. Maybe come back to the funding. So I know you already mentioned that your plans have changed a little bit as some of the funding that was available is no longer available. Can you speak to kind of that journey or how you guys are navigating that now? It sounds like, based on what you've said, is maybe taking a pause and kind of working with what you got now, maybe working more on the charging for now. But it sounds like so far about 8 buses that you thought you were going to get have been stopped. But has it been more than that, that you just like planning? You know, talk to me more about that.
In a theoretical long-term plan, yes, it's more than that, because we are planning to, you know, to purchase every year. From a definitive nature, 8. But really taking a step back, it's now, you know, making sure that we don't get over our skis. What is our annual budget allocation? This is our allocation every year for buses. We have a long-term asset plan and management plan for the buses that we have. So we have to be thoughtful in making sure that we don't, you know, spend 3x a diesel on electric, and we don't have the corresponding infrastructure. We don't have the corresponding, you know, tax credit or rebate or grant funds that are there. And so what we've decided is, especially based upon when the new administration's bill passed in July, we just said, okay, let's stop now and let this come through the system and we figure out what it is. We've heard everything from never again, can we do it, and to we just need to figure out the way to finance it and to do it, or nothing has changed. So we've heard all of it. So we'd like, okay, let's stop and actually think through how we want to approach this. And what that looks like is, even with, you know, our drive for electric bus infrastructure and acquisition of more buses, we were also looking at other alternative options as well. So propane to diversify, I think biofuels is something else that, so we had always had that approach. It allowed us to not stop, but to reallocate the resources as appropriate right now until we get more certainty on the EV framework, so to speak, just writ large, regardless of buses or whatever, just all of it. There's a lot of confusion and where people are going. But then on the budget side, yes, it's had an impact from a standpoint. We have some stakeholders, as you can imagine, that are like, nope, we said it. We should just go. We should go. But it's one of those is where like, well, that's great. But in 4 years, you all may be the same folks saying, why did we waste this money if we did not have X, Y, and Z in place? Or we didn't know for sure. Or there was the possibility that this program would end. Why do we keep going? So it's always that balance that's necessary. But no, it has the grant money and the rebates were a incredible and necessary carrot to get to get folks moving and to move with some urgency on our part, because that was necessary. That's the point of those programs, of course. But not having that now requires us to ensure that, okay, let's make sure our infrastructure is in place, because it's hard to defend making these purchases if we don't have the adequate infrastructure in the first place. from the electrification and the infrastructure part, that's why we're looking at alternative financing. What are our options that we have? Are there places where we can monetize and then pay for it ourselves? Because we are committed to continuing the work. We just want to be fiscally responsible with how we proceed, recognizing that, you know, budgets are finite. And unfortunately, most cases are decreasing in some categories.
Yeah, especially in public schools, often that's the case. Yeah. Well, maybe keying off a couple of things you mentioned in there, it may be too early to tell because it sounds like you're still getting some of the infrastructure kinks worked out for even the 29 that you have. Have you noticed, well, one of the big pitches that I've heard about an electric bus is, yeah, it's more expensive up front, but the O&M or operating costs are wildly cheaper, both in terms of fuel because you're not buying diesel and you're buying electricity, but it's way more efficient at using electricity, so that tends to be less cost. And then more importantly, just the maintenance of the vehicles themselves. The electric buses just have far less moving parts. Has that proven out so far, or have you had enough time to really know if that's true?
We probably will be at the stage of knowing that's true this summer, just from a standpoint of our annual maintenance. I can say that I have not heard anything rise to my level that, you know, we are doing more for these buses than we would normally do. And if where I sit, hearing nothing means it's great.
Fair enough. Yeah.
But no, I think it's still a little early. But, you know, when you look at what the electric bus does not have, like, you know, you don't have to change the oil. You don't have to do, you know, logically, it would have to be, you know, a better return there on the O&M side. The buses that we have now, it'll be about 2 year mark. And I think we will be at the place where, you know, they've had two cycles of returns and updates and asset management to where we can start to have some comparisons between the diesel and the electric buses.
That's great. Yeah. And then the other thing you mentioned was alternative financing options. I know another, you know, assuming that the O&M costs are cheaper and knowing that the capital cost is more, a lot of for-profit companies have been touting, hey, we'll sell you bus as a service, or we'll, you know, and I know some other school districts are working those types of models where they're not buying the buses, they're leasing the buses, or they're,
you know,
having the bus service as a service. Is that something that you're considering now, or how is that weighed into your evaluation? Makes sense why you didn't do it upfront if you had grant money. I mean, that sort of is the opposite of that, right? So it was there to buy the bus, but you know, I'll let you talk to that.
That pretty much is what we're examining now. So I don't know that this takes it off this topic for a minute, but I'll bring it back, is that Prince George's County, we are the first school district in the country to utilize private financing to build schools. So we are currently building, have delivered 6, and currently building 8 more schools right now. So utilizing that same concept of like, hey, let's get the capital taken care of, add long-term O&M, and then just pay it out over time. So we have already dove all the way into the alternative infrastructure process now. But what we need to identify as it relates to the alternative infrastructure, that construct, is dedicated revenue. Where can we pull, or what savings do we derive from going away from diesel? And that was kind of the construct of the electrification process that we're looking at, is what is our annual spend on diesel? If we buy X number of electric buses, what is the savings on diesel costs? And is that enough of a plug number to finance the capital cost of a new facility? So that literally is the exercise we're going through now. And to be frank, that's probably how we're going to restart the bus purchasing as well as the infrastructure, is utilizing some model similar to that. And what the contours of that look like, I don't know, but that's where we're headed. So because of the fact is that, you know, folks understand a mortgage, folks understand you take it out now and over a period of time. It's just that this approach is not new anywhere but in America, because we have the tax exempt markets. So that's the other piece of this, is we go that route, but then we have to defend why we're willing to pay 3.5-5% interest versus just pay go getting it for free on the tax exempt bond market. There's a different conversation than the urgency of building a school versus buses. Like, so it's those pieces that we're working through now. But you hit it. I believe that that's going to be the mechanism of which to continue the drive. Because if it's just going to be funded by grant money and rebate programs, it's not sustainable. And you have to get to a market structure to where it's competitive on just a per purchase standpoint without any of the enticements getting people into the market. And, you know, you do that to build the market, and then the market size allows you to then have, you know, the ability to have market rate buses and to sell them at a comparable price as diesel. That's the goal of all of this. I just see that that's going to take longer than it anticipated.
Yeah, not helped by some of the changes in Washington at this point, I imagine. I guess a couple other ancillary questions would be, one of the major pluses of electric buses that I've heard, you know, it's kind of touted as people that are promoting them, is the local air pollution. So the pollution for the kids actually riding the bus and in the neighborhoods that they operate. Did that enter into your conversation? Was that part of the original impetus to going down this road, or how has that played out for the buses that are in service?
Oh yeah, that was definitely the case. I mean, is that because it's part of the climate change action plan, the whole drive was to radically reduce carbon emissions by the school system. And so EV buses is just one route. We are now, all of the schools I told you about, 6 of the 8 will be net zero. All of our kitchens are going to all compostable materials. So it was front and center to the development of the climate action change, climate action policies, and top of mind for us. Our returns of that is that, you know, we have communities that are very happy that we are doing this. You know, we have incredibly high incidences in some neighborhoods of asthma. And so is that a contributing factor? Probably, yes. Exhaust in the air, I would assume, you know, to some level would be. So all of that was taken into account. And that's how you come up with a robust overarching plan like this, is we want to hit it everywhere possible, multi-pronged, so that if, in this case, funding stops on X, it doesn't stop us from continuing to move the ball for the conversation of resiliency and sustainability.
That makes sense. And speaking to resiliency, another kind of thing that I'll hear touted a lot with electric buses is you essentially have a roving backup generator, you know, to, in the case of an emergency, an electric bus, the amount of power that those things can hold, you know, in theory, not, you have to set it up the right way, could provide electricity for, you know, a small community center, for example, or a school if it's set up the right way. Have you gotten that far, or is that part of your infrastructure discussion that you're looking at now?
That's part of the infrastructure discussion. And we have had initial conversation with architects around this, around basically power back to the grid. It's a little different from just the size of schools, but, you know, you don't need to electrify the whole school, you know, maybe a portion, you know, and we're doing the same thing with the gas generator. And so that has come up. I know that there are early stage technologies around that. That's something that we will continue to explore. And what that will require us to do is look at how we design our design standards, because we have, you know, buses must be here relative to cars, relative to the building. So it's going to require some of our specifications, architectural specifications, to be updated. But that's definitely something that we started to talk about. And it will require us to have a different change in posture to our bus fleets. Like, you know, right now we have all of our buses come back to one lot or the lot that they're assigned to behind the fence every night. Now we're looking at, okay, if you have something like this, you probably need to have some type of setup to where the bus can stay at a school. Like, you know, there's a bus that's assigned, they do their route every day, but they're assigned to stay at this school. It seems simple, but a lot of things in the school system, because of how it's been done, is not. It just takes educating people and getting people to see where we're moving. those are things that we definitely have started to look at, and folks have come in to talk to us about it.
No, I really appreciate that. And generally appreciate your willingness just to tell us how it's going. And this stuff is new, and learning from other people's challenges and things that you've overcome, I think, is some of the stuff that's hardest to find out there in the market. With that in mind, as you're thinking of other people, I know you'll get in, you probably get inundated from other school districts saying, hey, you guys have more than zero buses. How did you do it? Like, you've learned some things. Can you give us a few do's, don'ts? You know, you've talked through a few of them in this conversation, but if you had to summarize for your colleagues, what advice would you give them that you wish you would have gotten yourself?
I think it really, really starts with strategic planning on this. Really be robust and then make it personal. Why do we want to do this? Because then when it becomes personal, the buy-in is natural. The buy-in is, it doesn't seem artificial. And you're able to keep it across administrations. So we've had, since the Climate Change Action Plan has been in place, we've had three leaders, and the work has continued because it was, you know, it is personal to us. It is deeply rooted, and it will continue. And then, you know, the other one is, you know, the community buy-in. Like, why are we doing it? Because they are ultimately funding us. It's either the reaction to your advocacy, or we're telling you, you know, why we feel that this is an important investment of resources. Compartmentalize what you've done abroad. Compartmentalize it. Stop trying to boil the ocean. Take a cup and boil that first. Like that's literally, you know, start somewhere. Once that happens, you're able to build momentum, but then also build advocates that see the work and that see the, you know, the benefit of the work. Just focus on being steady, strategic, and deliberate. You can get criticized for a lot of stuff, but usually you'll never get criticized for just being disciplined and strategic and just deliberate. What they say is, like, you know, you say the same thing over and over again, people realize that that's important. Be very intentional with everything that you do. But, you know, at the end of the day, enjoy too. Like, this stuff is pretty cool. Like, when you get to talking about and you realize how not smart you are, and there are some brilliant people that are doing some incredible things, and their ability to turn that into resources for schools, infrastructure for schools, buses for schools, I like to nerd out on and to see more of. That would be the words that I would have for others in other school districts, for sure.
That's great. Any materials or websites or anything you would throw anybody to learn more about what you're doing out there?
Yeah, I mean, our website is www.pgcps.org. Everything that I've talked about here, Climate Change Action Plan, private financing, any of that stuff, it's all publicly available on our website. Should folks have questions or need to know where to find stuff, please feel free to reach out to me as well. Easy to find, jason.washington@pgcps.org, and we will love to be a resource for you.
That's great. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time today and telling us a little bit about what's going on out there in Maryland, and wishing you guys nothing but the best of luck as you go to the next stage. It sounds like, if I'm doing my math right, you said about 1,000 buses. You're about 3% of the way there.
Yeah, we will get there. We will stay diligent, and it's a marathon, not a race.
Yeah, well, you're 3% further than most school districts, I guess, was going to be my point, so I appreciate that. Anyway, thank you a lot, Jason. Appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
And that's a wrap. Thanks again to Jason for sharing his perspective on migrating fleets to all electric. This episode was hosted and executive produced by Dave Carlscott, co-produced by Allison Bruns, Carmela Laharde, and me, Will Mangrum, and was edited by Christian Crawford. Our theme music is by Geo Washington Ryle and his studio big band. If you haven't already, make sure to follow the Campus Energy Sustainability Podcast on LinkedIn or Blue Sky. You can dive deeper into past episodes at campusenergypodcast.com. If you enjoyed today's show, leave us a quick review on your favorite podcast platform. It's fast, it's easy, and it helps spread the word to even more sustainability champions out there. This podcast is brought to you by Brelsford & Dunlady. As always, thanks for listening.